Vikings had time for them to run like 27-0. But, you know, I don't know, Winthrop. Winthrop's funny, you know. It's like Winthrop's the equivalent of like Quincy. They're actually quite equidistant. And it's always funny, it's because we're both neither really. I mean, okay, so compared to Marblehead, Quincy is South Shore. But, you know, we're both sort of gateway to the shore, where Winthrop's kind of gateway to the North Shore, because it's not really up there very high above Boston. It's actually east of Boston, slightly northeast. But enough of a dissertation on Winthrop. So tonight I'm going to talk to you about my third book, New England's General Stores. And, you know, it's really something of a labor of love for me. Not that I didn't love doing the other too much, but everybody at Chronicle knows there's a running joke that if I do one of my travel pieces, Main Streets and Back Roads, anywhere in New England, there's going to automatically be a diner in the show because they know that there are two sort of iconic New England institutions that I cannot pass by. One is a diner, the one is a classical New England general store. Now, there have been whole libraries made full with books about diners, so didn't need another book from me about diners, although I would have been happy to do the research. But curiously, not a lot written about general stores. And so my wife and I, who I co-wrote the book with, we were looking at that and we're like, wow, you know, it's such a, really not just New England. Originally, our plan was to do a book about America's general stores. And when we started looking at the logistics and the costs with the publisher, it was like, why don't you focus this on New England? And I think they saw, instead of flying around to do research, I could instead just get in my own damn car. So that made it attractive. But let me start out with, so the story of why we did this, I always like to say very quickly at the outset what the book is not, because it sounds like it might be a guide to New England's general stores. But it isn't. I have no interest in that. I have no interest in guidebooks. They're helpful. I just don't choose to put my time into putting a guidebook together. The reason why we're interested in doing this story is because the story of why general stores have mattered throughout history in New England, why they were threatened to the point of extinction, and why they have made something of a comeback, that's where the story is. That's where the story is. Which is why we're starting with a picture of a dodo bird, because the dodo is an example of an endangered species. And by the way, I am going to take questions if you have any. In fact, in this case, each one of you can have a question. I don't usually say that. Each one of you can have your own personal question. So keep notes in your head, what you want to ask. But I know probably your first question is, do I have enough for everybody? But I don't. On the other hand, I've been up since 4 a.m., so this is kind of keeping me going at this point. The dodo. So this is an example of an endangered species that became extinct. This is an example of a presently endangered species that is not yet extinct. And so is this. Now, here's an example of the type of predator that drove the dodo to extinction. In terms of the type of predator that has driven general stores to near extinction, I'll tell you that none of our hands are clean. I have consorted with one of these predators in the last 48 hours, and this one, and there are more. But here's the thing. It's not that they haven't taken casualties. Don't get me wrong. The big box stores, the chain organization, you know, they've certainly taken casualties, and I always point out most notable among them was Gray's, which closed in 2012. Gray's in Adamsville, Rhode Island was, at the time it closed, America's longest continuously operating general store, 224 years. That's a long run for business. The country had only been in business 10 years more. So, but the reason I chose these two modern iterations of Target and Walmart is to point up the fact these are new, but the demise of general stores is not new. It goes back well over half a century. In fact, when general stores began to be threatened, Sam Walton was still running a single store in Missouri. So I point out that it does go back half a century. In fact, I reread this past summer, I reread Travels with Charlie. And I was on a plane and reading it. And this jumped out at me because I was finished writing the book. And this jumped out at me, so I had to include it. Because look what John Steinbeck noticed more than half a century ago. He set out, as you probably know, in 1960 in his custom-made GMC pickup truck with a camper in the back, which he named Rosinante. Anybody know what Rosinante refers to? Librarians cannot answer because they know it.
Good, because I don't know.
Rosinante was Don Quixote's horse. Leave it to Steinbeck to name a pickup truck with a literary reference. But he circumnavigated America, right, with his best four-legged friend in 1960. Look what he noticed. Look what he noticed. That jumped off the page when I read that. Obviously, it didn't mean anything the first time I read it, 25 years ago. But he noticed that in 1960, that general stores were rapidly disappearing. But when he was born, this scene in Salinas, California, was familiar to everybody in America. It didn't matter whether you lived in a city or a country. You knew this in your kind of American DNA. You may have grown up patronizing a general store like this. Your parents almost certainly did. And so the question is why? Why did general stores go from being ubiquitous in every single town in America to a point where they were rapidly disappearing, as Steinbeck noticed? So the first thing is it has to do with mobility. After the Second World War, the economy mushrooms. There's a housing shortage, but there's jobs boom, and everybody is, the median income is skyrocketing. And in 1950, for the very first time, a majority of Americans own an automobile. And 20 years later, we have the complete mushrooming of the interstate highway system. And now Americans are mobile like never before. And when you live in a small town and you have had this choice at the local store, you now can jump in your car, run a couple of exits on the interstate, and you've got this choice. So this choice is dwarfed by this choice, and now this choice is going out of business. But a funny thing happened on the way to extinction. And that is the central irony about the book. That's the central irony to the general store story. It's the central irony that made me interested in writing the book, because it's this. The same forces that threatened the general store with extinction become the same forces that saved them. How's that? So, with mobility came the rise of suburbia, right? And by the late 60s, early 70s, you have the rise of what I call these super communities. Super communities. Median income has risen to the point where now people, the boomers mostly, can afford to live in these super communities with amenities that their parents could only have dreamed about, wonderful schools and athletic programs, and in the morning you can drive to work and hit a drive-through window and have your choice of four or five different places to get your coffee and your breakfast, bun, burger, burrito, whatever the hell you call it. And now, ironically, within 20 years of the rise of suburbia and the super communities, people are missing something. They don't even necessarily know what they're missing, but they're missing something. It's going to fall to a very interesting American to put his finger on what it was people were missing. But irony of ironies, in these super communities, they were missing community. And they may not even have realized that's what they were missing. But something, there was something that made people feel that in this community their parents could only have dreamed about, they felt oddly alone. A lot of people did. It fell to this wonderful American sociologist named Ray Oldenburg to put his finger on what it was. And the reason I include this is because it has everything to do with why general stores ended up being saved. Because what Ray Oldenburg found was, he called it the theory of the third place. And it's one of those theories that sounds so disarmingly simple, you think, well, yeah, I know that. No, you didn't. I didn't. Nobody did before Ray Oldenburg put his finger on what it was in, through his research. And he found that Americans, by and large, spend the bulk of our lives in one of just three places. Really. First place, you can probably guess, home, family. Second place, work, exactly. The third place is the key. The third place is not one place. It can be one of many types of places. It could be a house of worship. It could be a beauty shop or a barber shop. It could be a diner. It could be a public library. God bless them and keep them. It could be a general store. And what distinguishes a third place is that it is a place where you may go to do a specific task, get your hair done, get a carton of eggs, return a book, but every third place has very important things in common, and that is they are not done alone. You know, when you go to a third place, you may be returning a book or getting a carton of milk or getting your hair done, but you will be running into people you know, people from your community. It is a community place. It is, that makes it the third place. It's not work, it's not home, but it's vital. And by the 70s, the late 70s, third places were disappearing. The corner store was disappearing, whether it was in a small town or a big city. Family life was becoming more diffuse. You had rise of majority two-job families, both parents working. You had people moving to different jobs. Suburbs were being fractured, small towns. In 1971, Life magazine published a poll that a lot of Americans found disturbing, and that was that they said, the poll found that more than 61%, the majority, clear majority, of Americans said they had only infrequent contact with their next door neighbor. And that was unthinkable to people of the previous generation. So people were missing a sense of community. And that sense of community was disappearing. It was being punctured. It was being made more diffuse. And they missed it. They didn't necessarily even know what it was, but they missed it. And Ray Oldenburg put his finger on what it was. So what happens? So you get a lot of people in these communities, suburban communities. This is national, but I'm talking about New England. So all over the metropolitan Boston area, Providence, Manchester, New Hampshire even, you get these pockets of suburbs and urban areas where people are missing this sense of community. And when the boomers, when they're starting to start their own families, a large number of people felt that they wanted to leave these big suburban communities and recover that sense of community that they may have known growing up, their parents certainly knew growing up. They felt that it was important. They were missing this, and they were determined to recapture it. So a lot of them move out. I don't mean it to make it sound like a mass migration. However, it was real. A lot of people moved from the suburbs to these small towns in the early 70s to recover that sense of small-town community, and they moved to places where they found, lo and behold, these thriving third places. And suddenly they felt, this is what I'm talking about. And they found these wonderful, and the thing was, that's the 1940s, this is the 1990s, they were still thriving. They were still thriving, places like these general stores. And then you get to about 2000, and it's kind of a perfect storm, not a good one. It turns out the general store owners have a shelf life. It's about 20 years owning a general store. And for whatever reason, a lot of general store owners that are reaching the early 2000s had owned the stores for about 20 years. And a lot of them were retiring at the same time. Just one of those eerie data points, right? So these people who moved there suddenly realized, wait a minute, and these stores are closing. This is why they moved there. You have a lot of people who suddenly feel they're losing one of the central attractions that drew them to these small towns. In places like South Acworth, New Hampshire, which I use as the first example. It's the perfect example, time-wise, community-wise, of how the first stores that were saved in New England, you can't take just one store. So what happens is by around in and around 2000, there's a number of general stores that begin to be saved, and they're all saved the same way, by communities who come together, like in South Acworth. So those boomers who moved out of the suburbs and went to these small towns, they become the vanguard of the first wave that saves general stores. And South Acworth, as I say, is a perfect example because, like all the stores in this book, there had been a general store there for almost 200 years. Every store in the book had to exist for at least 100 years. Three quarters of the stores in the book have been around more than 200 years, all in the same footprint, and all, most importantly, are a genuine community gathering place. So in South Acworth, as I said, there had been a general store for almost 200 years, and in 2000, as I said, those store owners who had owned the store, actually they had owned it for 37 years, but in the wake of 9/11, what happened to them happened to a lot of businesses around New England that depended on tourism. Tourism goes up in some places almost 90%. like nobody was traveling, and they closed. And the community felt like they could not allow this to happen. And they came together, they bought the store as a community, they formed a co-op, people went to work in the store, they created a pizza oven out back to create more revenue, they do harvest dinners today, the South Acworth Village store is thriving like never before. We certainly hope the lights don't go out anytime soon in South Acworth. In North Shrewsbury, Vermont, where I was just about a month ago, a different story about taking a village to save the store. And it's a story of how, well, you talk about a perfect storm. In this case, it has a literal component. When this picture was taken in the early 1970s, Marjorie Pierce there was already in her early 70s. And at that point, her family, the Pierces, had owned and run Pierces for over 60 years. But she was, 20 years later, she was, if you're doing the math along with me, she'd be in her early 90s. And at that point, she really wants nothing more than to just take a little time off. The woman's over 90 years old. The problem is, there's nobody to run the store if Marjorie Pierce takes time off, literally, even a day. So, but she can't do it. The woman's 93. And nobody can begrudge her wanting to take some time off. Took time off, but that becomes closing the store. And it didn't reopen. And she felt terrible about it. She called up a really good friend of hers who is one of my favorite New Englanders. His name's Paul Broun. Paul Broun is a visionary. He is a pioneer. He is the executive director and the founder of the Preservation Trust of Vermont. You may not have heard of it, but I can almost guarantee you have seen what they do. Because what the Preservation Trust does, they started doing it in Vermont, now they do it all over America. But what they do is they help cities and towns preserve their history. And they don't do it through an overdeveloped sense of sentimentality or nostalgia. That's all very well and good, but it doesn't pay the rent. They do it because they have found over 45 years that when cities and towns hold on to their history, it might be a historic building, a theater, it might be a shopping district, it might be an entire main street. But what they have found is that when cities and towns preserve their history, they actually increase their economic sustainability as a municipality. When you lose your history, you lose some of that economic stability. So they actually have a proven case for the economic sustainability of holding on to history. And she called up Paul. She didn't have any of that in her mind. She just knows Paul, and she knows Paul can get things done. And she said, Paul, I need to reopen the store. And he said, Marjorie, I thought you were retired now. She said, oh, I am. You're going to do it. Well, he realized this is going to be a longer conversation, so Paul Broun jumped in his beat-up Prius, and he drove down from Burlington to North Shrewsbury, Vermont. And Marjorie went into more detail, and she said, I'm going to make you an offer you can't refuse. She said, I'm going to give you the store. And I'm also going to give you $10,000. It's pretty much all the money I have, but I don't expect to need it too much more. And he said, Marjorie, dear. And if I know Paul, he probably took her hand in his and patted her hand, and he said, Marjorie. You know that we don't own properties outright. You know that. That's not what we do. We never have. We don't own a single property outright. We help cities and towns find ways to invest in their own properties and become stakeholders, become owners. That's what we do. And she said, piffle. Well, they went back and forth, I think, a little bit. But long story short, about a half hour later, Paul was back in his Prius driving back to Burlington, and the Preservation Trust of Vermont owned its first property outright. As Paul told me, he said, I just couldn't say no to Marjorie Pierce. And so he did come back to North Shrewsbury a couple of weeks later, and he met with the group that had formed to kind of be the stewards of the store. But what they didn't know till Paul got back down there was they were going to run the store. None of them had ever run a business. None of them had any business experience whatsoever. But Paul has a way of kind of mentoring those who are intimidated by the idea of taking over property. And they did. And the wonderful group, like my friend Sally Deinzer, right there, and they took over and they completely renovated. I've always contended that the interior of the North Shrews, of Pierce's in North Shrews, Vermont, almost looks like a Hollywood set, right, of what an old New England General store would look like, but it looks exactly like that. I sat in that red chair just 4.5 weeks ago. So, and they reopened the store. There was some grousing. I won't say that the community was in lockstep with the co-op board. Just before, about a month before they were set to open, the co-op board went to the town and they said, it's our opinion we need to raise an additional $5,000 to buy an emergency generator. And people were grousing a little bit about that. They said, why do we need that? Marjorie Pierce never needed an emergency generator. But their point was that we are setting out to be a genuine community gathering place through thick and thin, through the worst that a Vermont winter can throw at us, and the community needs to know that no matter what, we will be here. People groused a bit, but they got the emergency generator, which is probably a good thing, because 2 years later, after reopening, Mother Nature intervened. Yeah, it turned out not to be the worst of a Vermont winter thrown at them, but the worst of a Vermont late August. Who would have thunk? But with Hurricane Irene, which was downgraded at that point to a tropical storm in late August, when it hit the Green Mountains, it was packing 67-mile-an-hour winds instead of the 75 of a hurricane, but it doesn't really matter at that point. You know, that's still going to blow away 200-year-old covered bridges like Irene did all through Vermont. And the first day that Irene tore up into the Green Mountains, the power and the lights went off all over Vermont, including North Shrewsbury, Vermont, except one little place. Because in North Shrewsbury, the co-op trudged over through the howling wind and debris, and they fired up the emergency generator, and the lights came on. At the hear of Sally Dines tell, she said, you were looking out that plate glass window. Late afternoon on the first day Irene hit, she said, and we threw the lights on, and she said, it looked like something out of Night of the Living Dead. She said, you could see people coming up the street, seeking out the light. And they got there, and they got the Pierces, and the lights were on, and the coffee was hot, and the Wi-Fi was working, and people were able to email and call their relatives and tell them everything was okay. And curiously, nobody has ever groused about that emergency generator again. Now, we talked about the community. So the first wave of General Store preserving them was done by communities coming together. That still happens. But that was the first wave where there was a bunch of them saved that way. And there have also been just wonderful individuals who single-handedly have been able to save the store. I have them in a chapter in the book I call Honey, I Bought the Store, like Ferns in Carlisle, Mass. And I have some fun with my friend Larry Bearfield, who I say is the only person in the chapter to have actually uttered the words, Honey, I Bought the Store. Now, Larry tells me I'm wrong. He says, I didn't say that. I said, Honey, we're going to buy the store. I said, Larry, either way, that's a sign of a very overconfident husband. But my favorite Honey, I Bought the Store, though, involves perhaps the most or the least likely General Store owner, America's worst boss. Close your eyes for a minute and get a picture in your head. See what comes into your mind's eye if you think about the picture of a husband and wife owners of a proud, historic, old New England General Store. Husband and wife that own this old New England General Store in a little New England town. You got a picture in your head? All right, does it look like this? Not quite? Well, you're looking at the husband and wife owners of a proud, old New England General Store in a little New England town, believe it or not. Steve Carell grew up in Acton. And when I talked to Steve in the process of writing the book, he told me that when he grew up in Acton, that was a little old general store, long gone, and he said it was the first place that he was allowed to go by himself on his little bike with his little allowance in his pocket and buy some penny candy, which now will run you upwards of 75 cents to a buck. But that turns out to be the case. It may be the case for some of you, too, that that was your experience. It was the same for his wife, Nancy. She grew up on the South Shore in Cohasset, and she and her big sister, Tish, used to go to Marshfield next door, where there was the Marshfield Hills General Store, and they would buy candy or ice cream on a hot summer night. And about 14 years ago, Nancy's big sister, Tish, went out to L.A. About this time of year, Christmas time, to visit her sister and her famous brother-in-law. And while she was there, she told Nancy that the Marshfield General Store was up for sale. And she said, not only that, as far as I know, no, there's been no interest in buying it. And she said, not only that, she pulled out a copy of the Globe and she said, check this out. And a local developer had proposed turning it into condos. And Steve said at that point, he went into the room where they were talking. And long story short, when Nancy's sister returned east that Christmas time, she had with her a check to purchase the Marshfield Hills General Store, which she did. And it's a wonderful, you know, store. It is still one of the few general stores in New England that still has an attached and functioning official post office. That used to be the case with all general stores, invariably. In fact, invariably, the general store owner was the town's postmaster. But that's almost never the case anymore. Very, very few. You can count them on one hand. But Marshfield Hills is one of them. On the third floor in the attic of the store during the Civil War, they stitched Union Army uniforms. And I think that Steve Corral and Nancy and Tish and their design team did an amazing job of keeping the store looking exactly the same as it always looked. And Steve made his sister-in-law, Tish, the manager of the store. She manages it today. And Steve and his family own a house in Cohasset. They come out to the South Shore for about 3 or 4 weeks every summer. And today, no summer in Marshfield today is complete without a confirmed Corral sighting, as you can see. Now, I've also felt when I talk about the book and these stores that it's important to pay some homage to some stores that have never been threatened, never been up for sale. Doesn't mean that the stores that have been up for sale, as you can see, they've had great community support in saving them. But some of them are what I call tried and true. They feel like they've been there forever, all of them more than 200 years, and they've never been up for sale. They've never moved. They've never closed. One of my favorites is in Warren, Vermont, up in ski country, kind of between Waitsfield, Warren, kind of between Mad River Glen and Sugarbush. More than 200 years. That's the 1940s, early 1940s. It's a wonderful place. I don't know if any of you have been there, but it's just the most welcoming place. And I dropped in last about, it was March 2016. And it was presidential primary season when I dropped in to say hi to my friend Jack Garvin, who owns the store. And I asked him what's going on, what's new. He said, oh, let's see. He said, oh, he said, we're having some fun. We're having a naming contest for the Woodstone. Now, the Warren store has the biggest functioning, working cast iron wood stove that I've ever seen. It's huge, it's almost floor to ceiling. So they were having it's really the central character of the store. And so they're having a contest to name the stove. It gets quiet and boring in the winter up there, so you gotta come up with some fun things to do. And I said, well, you got any good candidates for new names yet? He said, ah. He said, very funny you should put it that way. So the store had a good friend of theirs drop in about a week before me. And he was a pretty busy guy at that time of his life, at that point in time. He was pretty busy. He might have been back in Vermont, for all I know, just doing his laundry, because he was pretty busy. But he came in, and Jack told him about the contest. And lo and behold, he said, I have a suggestion. And they liked it. They ended up going with it. Yeah, you knew it was going to be Bernie. Right. They ended up naming it Bernie after Bernie Sanders. Right. So I think it's interesting because, you know, Bernie took from that experience that he lost the Democratic presidential nomination, but he never points out that he won the stove naming contest at the Warren store. That's not nothing. Didn't net him any delegates, but, you know, it's something. Now, there are also a couple of stores I like to share because these have their own, literally their own category, because they are everything we've talked about. They are tried and true. They are tried and true, but they are also so unique, they needed their own chapter. And you have to see it. There's no point in my explaining it. One of my favorites is Dannewitz, which is in Norwich, Vermont, or just over the Connecticut River from Hanover, New Hampshire, so the upper valley there, right? Now, Dan and Witt were not the original owners. Dan and Witt were school chums, high school buddies in the 1930s who worked at the store. And when the store came up for sale, the original owners closed it, or the owners at that time closed it in the 1950s. Dan and Witt bought it. And business was very well, very good. They wanted to expand. They really couldn't expand in front because they were confined. There's a store on this side, the Norwich Inn on this side, but they did have 3/4 acre behind the store. Now, Witt wasn't really sure about that. He thought, well, people aren't going to see it. They're not going to get excited about this expansion because they won't even see it going on. And Dan was adamant that, no, trust me, this will be good. And they did it. You know, you'll find this sign in, as you come into Dan and Witt's, and you'll find that a variation in almost every general store. I would make the point that Dan and Witt's, the reason I throw it up there is because it might actually be true. Because what they did was, so when you walk into Dan and Witt's, it's small. In fact, I would warrant that from the front door to where that guy and his son are at the refrigerator is not even as far from that wall to the back wall, not even that far. But when you go to the left of where they're standing, there's a simple doorway. There's no sign. But when you go through the doorway, you are in the back. And the back will swallow you up. It swallowed me up. I got lost the first time I was in the back. It's sort of like, think of it, it's sort of like a corn maze, but with products. And so that's not the end of it there, right there. It just jogs to the left a little bit and then goes back further. And I kept walking around, and I couldn't find my way out. And it was kind of embarrassing, because it wasn't like I didn't know where I was. And it wasn't like I couldn't even hear. I could hear people. But you don't want to be the person who says, you know, help. So kind of embarrassing. So finally, I did find my way out. And I went to Dan Frazier, who is original Dan's grandson. And I said, I got lost back there. And he said, oh, don't worry about it. It happens all the time. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, so at Dan and Witt's, they have the equivalent of like the commercial, the store equivalent of the ski patrol. You know, the ski patrol at a ski area, when the lifts close, right, they send somebody out on all the trails to flush it out, make sure nobody's stuck there when it gets dark. That's what they do at 9 o'clock at Dan and Witt's. They send somebody out back to flush out the back. And I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, oh, yeah, once a week, once every 2 weeks at the most, we'll find like some little kid wandering around. And I said, oh, my God, that's terrible. He said, yeah, you know what's really terrible is usually we know for a fact that the kid's parents left an hour ago. Yeah, I didn't know what to say, so I won't. So in Windsor, Maine, my other favorite one of a kind, Hussey's. Now, it looks like Hussey, but Harlan Hussey was a German immigrant. Now, he had a store going, and it was a smallish, almost garage-like thing all for decades. And then by the 1950s, he added on 2 floors. It had a basement level, and it had a second floor, and it became the commercial colossus of Windsor, Maine, which is not hard to do because there's nothing else in Windsor, Maine. But nonetheless, it is a truly unique place. If you start reading that sign at the bottom, now, it may not, the surprise doesn't come till later, but, you know, home and garden, wood stoves, plumbing, electrical, paint, hardware, camping gear, fishing, hunting supplies, guns, bridal gowns, clothes, wait, what? Right. So, Hussey's in Windsor, Maine is unique in all the world because it's the only general store where you can buy guns, gowns, and beer. Which basically makes Hussey's one-stop shopping for a shotgun wedding, which is exactly what Harlan Hussey's granddaughter had to have some fun with on her own wedding day, where she posed with the bridal bouquet, a six-pack of Schlitz, and the lucky groom is holding a brand new 12-gauge. So now, as I finish up, I do want to get a little bit serious, only in that I started doing the talk a couple of months ago, 2.5 months ago or so, when the book came out. And invariably, people would ask me afterwards if I had a favorite store. And at a certain point, because I was asked literally every single talk I gave, I said, you know what, I need to make that part of the talk. Mostly because I just got tired of answering that question. No, I'm kidding. So I am sharing with you why this is my favorite store. And, you know, the thing is, it's not my favorite store because it is a particularly unique physical building, because it isn't. It's perfectly nice. It's very nice. But it's not dramatically different from any number of other classic New England stores. It's not because it sells something unique. It doesn't. It is because It is the ultimate Rocky of general stores. It has fought back. In other words, it would seem to people of Putney, Vermont, that the fates have tried to tell them for 100 years that the store shouldn't be there. And yet it is. A.M. Courser, one of more than 15 different owners of Putney's, which has sat on the same physical spot just up from Sackett's Brook in the middle of Putney, Vermont. And it has been the heart and soul of Putney, Vermont since 1796. But it looked a way that, well, didn't look like that on an awful night in early May 2008. Some faulty wiring in the attic caused a fire to break out about 2 o'clock in the morning. Thank God for volunteer fire departments, because they got there pretty quickly, and it looks terrible, but they were actually able to save almost 2/3 of the store. And there was extensive damage, but they were able to rebuild. It fell to wonderful locals like Sally Papazian of the local historical society, and Sally's first call the next morning after the fire was to our friend Paul Brew. And he came down, and they met, and he said, here's what you got to do. We have to make the Historical Society, now going forward, owners of the store. That's going to be the best thing for the store's future, trust me. And they found, he helped them find federal funding, they found state funding, they found matching grants, they got donations, and they were able to rebuild. And the Putney General Store was gleaming and shining, and the beating heart of Putney once more. And all was good, but only for about a year and a half, incredibly.
Oh, no.
Because only a year and a half later, tragedy struck. Literally, a year and a half after they had completely rebuilt. But this picture, as bad as it looks, the reality is it's actually worse than it looks. Because this time there was no faulty wiring, but there was massive accelerant found, arson. So the good people of Putney, Vermont had to deal with the double gut punch that not only had they just lost, after a year and a half of rebuilding, not only had they just lost the heart and soul of Putney, but they had to contend with the horrifying reality that the person who did this might be the neighbor. So it was, building burned right down to the foundation stones, complete loss, gone. Just completely gone. And that late fall and early winter, people in Putney spoke about feeling as if there had been a death in the family, which in a very real way there had been, because the store was really an extension of everybody's family. And people were distraught. And Sally Papazian called Paul Brune once again. And Paul said, I just don't know right now. But he, as he described to me, he was trying to lay out how brutal the reality was, redoing this a year and a half later, but he said Sally was speaking through choked sobs on the phone, and he said, I will be down. I will come down. In fact, he drove down. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and he drove down so he would be there. He slept in his car for a couple of hours when he got there, and 9 o'clock in the morning, they met at the church across the street, and there were a lot of tears and a lot of anguish and a lot of frustration. And within half an hour, about another 30, 40 people from town heard about the meeting. Within an hour or so, there was over 100 people. They had to move the meeting outside into the cold air. And finally, this older gentleman whose family went back 5 generations in Putney stood up on the low stone wall by the street there, and he said, all I have to say is I will be goddamn if an arsonist is going to define my town. And Paul Brune kind of let those words kind of sit in the air. And then he stood up and he said, well, I think what my friend here is saying is we need to rebuild. And they did. And this time they got donations from all over the country. The second fire was front page news. The second fire was covered by most major media outlets across the country because it was just so devastating. But the hidden lining was donations came in from all over the country, actually all over the world. Timber was donated, local sawyer donated his time to cut it, and the store reopened as beautiful and more than ever. They immediately found, through good fortune, someone to run the store, a local pharmacist who said, if I can run my pharmacy on the second floor, I'd be happy to run it. And all was good until this past January 1st. No. I told you this was Rocky. So Rocky gets beat down before he gets back up, right? January 1st, New Year's Day, 2017, this wonderful gentleman who was running the store died. And unfortunately, neither of his children wanted to have anything to do with running the store. So the store closed. And Paul Bruhn heard about it, and he called up Sally, who pays him. And he said, Sally, I know that all of you have lives to live and jobs to keep and responsibilities, but I'm telling you, there's 31 of you. You have got to find a way to put in a few hours a week and reopen that store until you find somebody to run it full time, because I will tell you, the longer that store stays closed, you can multiply each day by 10 how much longer it will be before you reopen. I know how this works. And so stores open, closed for 3, 4, 5 weeks. They're doing the math. By Paul's math, this means the store will be closed more than 3.5 months. And people in Putney were devastated all over again. So they found a way to put in their time, even though none of them were business people. And they opened the store again in May. They are still looking for someone to run it. But the store is open once again. And as Paul Bruhn puts it so well, I think Putney is about perseverance, for sure. Now, just to finish, I think it's important to point out in a chapter at the end called The New Breed, which is kind of an epilogue, because here's the thing. I wasn't interested in creating a guidebook to general stores, but I also wasn't interested in creating just this musty history of general stores and how they've been saved. Because if it weren't for the new breed of general store owners, all the stores that I just talked to you about, within 20 years, they'd all be closed. And they'd all be closed for good. Because there is a new breed that is owning general stores, reopening general stores. They are now the vanguard, right? Their parents, in some cases grandparents, were the first vanguard to save the general stores. This new breed now are those folks who are keeping these stores going, will keep them going into the future because they're young enough. Perfect example in Monterey, Mass, out in the Berkshires, where Alex Cole owned a restaurant in Lenox, used to drive by the long-closed Monterey General Store for years and thought, someday I'm going to reopen that store. Then one day he just decided to move up retirement and reopen it. But here's the thing. If somebody walked into the Monterey General Store who had last been in there 100 years ago, they would immediately recognize the wide pine wood floor. But they wouldn't necessarily recognize the food that Cole is doing at the store now. They might not know, for instance, what a Calabrese salad is. But that's what's keeping the Monterey General Store open, because Monterey today, in 2017, is not the Monterey that existed 100 years ago. So the store that serviced Monterey 100 years ago wouldn't work today. And in that sense, and I'm sure Patty would bear me out, general stores have something in common with libraries, public libraries today. You have to serve the community you're in, right? And what works in Marblehead is not necessarily what's going to work in East Boston, where you have a 70% immigrant population. It's not what's going to necessarily work in North Adams. It's not what's going to work in Pittsfield or Fall River. You have to serve the community you're in. That's true today more than ever for general stores. What works, for instance, in Monterey might not work in Pittsfield, Vermont, than the original general store, where I will submit to you, you know, you have owners who are perhaps the second least likely general store owners in America, Katie Stiles and Kevin Lasko. Katie's a publicist, or was a publicist, for some of Manhattan's most famous restaurants. Her husband, Kevin, 4-star rated Michelin chef at Le Parc. But they decided to chuck it all and reopen the original store in Pittsfield, where, again, if you walked in and you had last been in this store 100 years ago, you would recognize almost everything in the front part. But in the back, Kevin created his dream kitchen, where he is being a chef again, but he's doing it now the way he always dreamed of doing, which is to say, 3 nights a week, he does a single seating chef's dinner. And this has gotten attention from every major food magazine in America, where that's what's keeping the Pittsfield store open today, the revenue that has created. Because Pittsfield, Vermont today is not the Pittsfield, Vermont of 100 years ago. Same thing is true, lastly, in Whitefield, Maine, where I will agree, Benatar and Marcus might look a little more like General Stoneman Homes, but don't be fooled. They're not. They're farmers. Had no interest in ever running a general store. They met in agriculture school in Washington State. And when they graduated, Ben was from Whitefield, so they moved back to Whitefield, Maine, hoping to perhaps purchase some land to farm. But that's expensive, and they weren't able to do it. It was futile. And finally, a local guy came up to him, and he said, look, I know you're looking for some land to buy to farm, and I'm willing to make you a crazy offer. He said, what? He said, well, I'll give you 5 acres of prime farmland. They said, what's the catch? He said, the catch is, on my land, there is a defunct, long-closed general store, Sheepskit General. If you reopen the store, the land is yours. They still anguished about it. That's how little interest they had in running a business. So they hedged their bets a little. They only bought stuff for the store that they liked, especially food. They only bought food that they liked to eat. Because the thought was that when this whole thing goes belly up, at least we can personally liquidate the inventory, right? And we won't have to shop for a month and a half. But it didn't work out that way. The land produced, don't get me wrong, fantastically, better than they could have hoped. That's been farming. But after about 6 months, they started to think, maybe there's a way we can sell our produce at the store instead of spending all of our week driving hundreds of miles to every single farmer's market all over New England. And so they searched for someone who wanted to open a cafe at the store, and they found somebody, and it completely took off. And people were raving about the cafe at Sheepskit General, and now Sheepskit General is thriving in a way it hadn't even as a general store back when it was open. They now have wine tastings, open mic nights, yoga classes, childcare. They have a lending library now at the Sheepskit General store. It's popular with young, it's popular with old, and this is a perfect example of what I think gives me hope in a way that, well, perfect. How perfect is that? Hope General Store in Hope, Maine reopened last year. So I think that gives hope that there is the third place will still be preserved, at least as far as general stores go, I think well into the future. And that is Boyle's General Stores. Thank you. Thank you very much. So I did.